And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West, and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's April 26th, 116th day of the year. 249 days remain till the year's over with. And the war in Europe still rages on. And now, everybody's saying that we've actually started World War III. We're just late getting there. And certainly, that is a possibility. And to show you how well respected our leaders are, well, 1348, Czech King Kirill IV founds the Charles University in Prague, what later named after him was the first university in Central Europe. 1336, French Tetrarch, as he's known, ascends Mount Ventoux. 1348, the Pazzi family attack on Lorenzo de' Medici kills his brother Giuliano during High Mass in Florence Cathedral. Considered very bad form to commit murder during Mass. 1564, playwright William Shakespeare is baptized in Stratford-upon-Avon, Warwickshire, England. His date of birth is actually unknown. And in fact, there's question as to whether there actually was a William Shakespeare. Or maybe Francis Bacon wrote everything that was supposed to be done by Shakespeare. 1607, a Virginia company colonists make landfall at Cape Henry. 1721, massive earthquake devastates the Iranian city of Tabriz. 1777, Cyril Ludington, 16, rode 40 miles to alert American colonial forces to the approach of the British regular forces. 1794, Battle of Beaumont during the Flanders Campaign of the War of the First Coalition took place on this date. 1802, Napoleon signs a general amnesty to allow law, but about 1,000 of the most notorious emigres of the French Revolution to return to France. 1803, thousands of meteor fragments fall from the skies of L'Algo, France. The event convinces European scientists meteors do exist. Before that, they said there's no way rocks could fall from the sky because there are no rocks in the sky. Can't see them. 1805, the First Barbary War. U.S. Marines captured Nern under the command of First Lieutenant Presley O'Banion. 1865, Union cavalry troopers corner and shoot dead John Wilkes Booth, assassin of President Abraham Lincoln in Virginia. There's question about whether or not they actually did kill John Wilkes Booth, believe it or not. The body that was taken for autopsy, in many respects, did not resemble Booth. 1900, fires destroy Canadian cities, Ottawa and Hull, reducing them to ashes in 12 hours. 12,000 people left without a home. 1903, Atletico Madrid Association Football Club is founded. 1915, World War I, Italy secretly signs the Treaty of London, pledging to join the Allied powers. 1920, ice hockey makes its Olympic debut at the Antwerp Games, with center Frank Fredriksson scoring 7 goals in Canada's 12-1 drubbing of Sweden in the gold medal match. 1923, the Duke of York leads Lady Elizabeth Bowles Lyon at Westminster Abbey. And the Duke of York actually became George the VI. And he was king until 1952. And he was also the last emperor of India until August of 1947, when the British Raj was dissolved. I met his wife. Yeah, very nice lady. Smiled a lot, didn't say much. 1925, Paul von Hindenburg defeats Wilhelm Marx in the second round of the German presidential election to become the first directly elected head of state of the Weimar Republic. And, frankly, the last one. 1933, the Gestapo, the official secret police force of Nazi Germany, is established by Hermann Göring. 1933, Nazi Germany issues the law against overcrowding in schools and universities, limiting the amount of Jewish students able to attend public schools and universities. I never have understood the true cause of Hitler's hatred of the Jews, since he was part Jewish. 1937, Spanish Civil War. Guernica, Spain is bombed by the German Luftwaffe. 1942, Benito Caldera accident in Manchuco leaves 1,549 Chinese miners dead. 1943, the Easter riots break out in Uppsala, Sweden. Now, the Easter riots is the name actually given to a period of unrest in Uppsala, Sweden during Easter of 1943. The National Socialist Group, Swedish Socialist Unity, previously the National Socialist Workers' Party, held its National Congress in Uppsala amid the Second World War and only days after events like the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. The unrest climaxed April 26th when the Swedish Socialist Unity, who, after initially belonging to a Strasserist wing of the National Socialism, began adopting a more indigenous form of fascism in 1938, ended the Congress by holding a demonstration at the Royal Mount of... excuse me, Old Uppsala. I don't know why I'm coughing so much this morning. In 1944, Georgios Papandreou becomes head of the Greek government in exile based in Egypt. Also in 44, Heinrich Kreip is captured by Allied commandos in occupied Crete. He was a German career soldier who served in both World War I and World War II. And while leading the German forces in occupied Crete in April of 44, he was abducted by British commandos with the support of Cretan resistance. He actually died in 1976. He's 81 years old. 1945, World War II, Battle of Bautzen, last successful German tank offensive of the war and the last noteworthy victory of the Wehrmacht. Also in 45, World War II, Filipino troops of the 66th Infantry Regiment, Philippine Commonwealth Army, and the American troops of the 33rd and the 37th Infantry Division are liberated in Bagao, and they fight against the Japanese forces under General Tomoyuki Yamashita. In 1954, the Geneva Conference, an effort to restore peace in Indochina and Korea, begins. Didn't work. Also in 54, the first clinical trials of Jonas Salk's polio vaccine begins in Fairfax County, Virginia. 1956, SS Ideal X, the world's first successful container ship, leaves Port Newark, New Jersey for Houston, Texas. 1958, the final run of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Royal Blue from Washington, D.C. to New York City took place on this date. It was the final run after 68 years. It was the first U.S. passenger train to use electric locomotives. Must have had a hell of a long extension cord. 1960, forced out by the April Revolution, President of South Korea, Syngman Rhee, resigns after 12 years of dictatorial rule. 1962, NASA's Ranger 4 spacecraft crashes into the moon. 1962, the British space program launches its first satellite, the Ariane 1. On this date, 1963, in Libya, amendments to the Constitution transform Libya's United Kingdom of Libya into one national unity called the Kingdom of Libya. It allows for female participation in elections. 1964, Tanganyika and Zanzibar emerged to form the United Republic of Tanzania. 1966, a magnitude 5.1 Tashkent earthquake affects the largest city in Soviet Central Asia with a maximum MSK intensity of 7, which is considered very strong. Tashkent's almost destroyed, and 15 to between 15 and 200 people are killed. 1966, new government is formed in the Republic of the Congo, led by Ambroise Nuwimbila. 1970, the convention establishing the World's Intellectual Property Organization comes into force. 1981, Dr. Michael Harrison of the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center performs the world's first human open fetal surgery. 1982, 57 people are killed by former police officer Woo Bum Khan in a shooting spree in South Gyeongsang Province in South Korea. 1986, the Chernobyl disaster occurs in the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. 1989, the deadliest known tornado strikes central Bangladesh, kills around 1,300, injures over 12,000 more, and leaving as many as 80,000 homeless. 1989, People's Daily publishes the April 26 editorial, which inflames a nascent Tiananmen Square protest. 1991, 55 tornadoes break out in central U.S. Before the outbreaks in, Andover, Kansas would record the year's only F5 tornado. 1993, the Space Shuttle Columbia is launched on mission STS-55 to conduct experiments aboard the Space Lab module. 1994, China Airlines Flight 140 crashes at Nagoya Airport in Japan, kills 264 of the 271 people on board. 1994, South Africa begins its first multiracial election, which is won by Nelson Mandela's African National Congress. 2002, Robert Steinheiser kills 16 at Gutenberg Gymnasium in Erfurt, Germany, before dying of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. 2005, Cedar Revolution. Under international pressure, Syria withdraws the last of its 14,000-troop military garrison in Lebanon, ending its 29-year military domination of that country. 2015, their Sultan Nazarbayev is re-elected president of Kazakhstan with 97.7% of the vote. I doubt that. 2018, American comedian, in the last election here for president, over, what was it? Several hundred people over the age of 120 voted, and the oldest person in the country just died at 119. But nobody saw anything wrong about that because the wonderful Joe Biden was elected. And the election was blessed by the great God Obama. 2018, American comedian Bill Cosby is convicted of sexual assault. 2019, Marvel Studios' blockbuster film Avengers Endgame is released, becoming the highest-grossing film of all time, surpassing the previous box office record of Avatar. Well, a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Chernobyl disaster. Day of remembrance of the Chernobyl tragedy in Belarus. Memorial Day of radiation accidents and catastrophes in Russia. Christian Feast Day. Aldobrandadesa, or Alda. Franca Vesalta. Lucidius of Verona, Our Lady of Good Counsel. Pope Anselitus and Marcellinus, Raphael Arnaz Baron, or Baron, Ricaire, Pesacius, Redbertus, Peter of Rates, or Braga, depending on your upbringing, Robert Hunt in the Episcopal Church in the U.S., Stephen of Perm, Trudpert, Confederate Memorial Day in Florida, Union Day in Tanzania, and it's World Intellectual Property Day. Let's see what else we got. Uh, 757, Paolo Orsini replaces his brother Pope Stephen II as Pope Paul I. 1220, German King Frederick II grants bishops sovereign rights. 1467, the miraculous image of Our Lady of Good Counsel appear in Genazzano, Italy. In 1514, astronomer and mathematician Nicolaus Copernicus makes his first observation of Saturn. In 1654, the Jews are expelled from Brazil. 1655, in a remarkable show of good sense, the Dutch West Indies Company denied Peter Stuyvesant's desire to exclude Jews from New Amsterdam. 1677, Emperor Leopold I forms University of Innsbruck. 1755, the first Russian university opens in Moscow. 1814, King Louis XVIII lands at Calais from England. Louis XVIII was the King of France. 1814 to 1824, except for a period in 1815 known as the Hundred Days. Spent 23 years in exile from 1791 to 1814 during the French Revolution and the First French Empire, and again in 1815 during the period of the Hundred Days when Napoleon came back from Elba. He died 1824 at the age of 68. In 1819, the Oddfellows Lodge forms. 1828, Russia declares war on Turkey to support Greece's independence. 1841, the Bombay Gazette begins publishing on silk, no less. 1853, the Dutch King William III disbands the Second Chamber. 1859, Don Sickles is acquitted of murder on the grounds of temporary insanity. That's the first time this defense was used successfully in the U.S. On this day in 1865, Confederate General J.E. Johnston surrendered the remaining forces under his command to Union General William Sherman at Bennett Place in Durham, North Carolina. This effectively ended the U.S. Civil War. In 1887, Huntsville Electric Company forms to sell electricity. 1893, the first Cleveland Board of Park Commissioners is formed. 1900, the newly renamed American League opener in Cleveland draws 6,500 folks. It was still considered minor league, as was considered the Western League. 1904, Bell Telephone Company of Antwerp, Belgium forms. 1904, General Kuroko leads the Japanese army against the large Russian force at the Yalu River during the Russo-Japanese War. 1906, motion pictures begin to regularly be shown at the Orpheum Theater in Honolulu, Hawaii. 1913, Sun Yat-sen calls for revolt against President Yuan Shikai in China. Shikai was a president and a general. 1925, the Pulitzer Prize is awarded to Edna Ferber for So Big. 1925, artist Diego Rivera resigns from the Mexican Communist Party. 1926, Germany and Russia sign a neutrality peace treaty. 1928, Madame Tussauds' waxwork exhibition reopens in London after a fire. 1929, the first nonstop England to India flight lands. Let's see. 1938, Austrian Jews are required to register all property worth above 5,000 Reichsmarks. 1941, potatoes are rationed in Holland. 1944, the first B-29 is attacked by Japanese fighter planes. One fighter is shot down. 1945, Marshal Philippe Pétain, leader of the French's Vichy collaborationist regime during World War II, is arrested for treason. 1949, Transjordan is officially renamed the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. 1952, the U.S. minesweeper Hobson rammed the aircraft carrier Wasp. 176 are killed. 1957, Jamestown, Virginia's 350th anniversary festival begins. On this day in 61, the French paratroopers revolt suppressed in Algeria. 1966, an earthquake of 7.5 magnitude destroys Tashkent, Uzbekistan. 1968, student seized administration building at Ohio State. 1971, saw the heaviest rains ever in the Bahia District of Brazil, 15 inches in 24 hours. 1971, Turkey has a state of siege proclaimed. 1976, Pan Am begins nonstop flights from New York City to Tokyo. 1978, France sends troops to Chad. 1982, Argentina surrenders to Great Britain on the South Georgian island of near the Falkland Islands. The Argentinian prisoners of war marched to Port Stanley after their surrender. 1982, and this will teach you to flaunt what you have. Some Rod Stewart's mugged. Gunman steals his $50,000 Porsche on Hollywood Boulevard, Los Angeles, California. Is nothing sacred. There are gangs who get assignments of who to rob and what to take. And of course, California firmly believes that you get a second, third, and fourth chance.1986 saw the world's worst nuclear disaster. The fourth reactor at Chernobyl nuclear power station in USSR explodes, killing 31 people. Radioactive contamination reaches much of Western Europe. Okay, what else have we got? I think that pretty much does our history segment for today. It's in history been an eventful day all the way around. You know, a couple of other things too. You know, this is without a doubt a very strange world. There have been let's just say unusual occurrences in almost every facet. You know, we've been talking about almost everything you can imagine. And I've still got as many strange topics to talk about. You know, I've been doing this show now, let's see, 30 years. And there's always something new and bizarre to discuss. Okay. Let's see if I... If my system go... There we go. One of the strangest... topics of discussion is all the bizarre things found in this country. You know, as I said yesterday, one of the reasons for the Lewis and Clark expedition... You know, the taking of land by more advanced countries who would go in and see an area they like and colonize it was authorized by the Pope, provided there was no Christian civilization. And one of the things that the Lewis and Clark expedition was going to do was see who else was on the North American continent. Now, they found some true marvels, no question about it. How about the Monk's Mound? Largest earthwork on the continent. It's 100 feet tall. It's the largest man-made prehistoric mound in North America. It's 1,000 feet long, 800 feet wide, composed of four platform terraces. Archaeologists estimate 22 million cubic feet of earth was used to build this mound between the years 900 and 1200 AD. I've got one question for you. Why would somebody go to the trouble to build something like that? Now, since the time it was built, the mound has eroded or been damaged to the point that nobody really knows how large it really was. Even more curious than the existence and sudden disappearance of a vast culture is the surprising discovery of what appears to be a massive stone structure lying hidden below the massive Monk's Mound. January 24, 1998, while drilling to construct a water drainage system at the mound, workers hit a 32-foot-long stone structure. It was investigated by an archaeologist from the Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. His name was William Woods. He led the investigation of this mystery structure. It's at least 32 feet long, buried 40 feet below the surface of a terrace on the western side of Monk's Mound, and well above the mound's bottom. And he noted, even if that structure turns out to be just a large slab of rock, it'd still be a dramatic find because the nearest source of stone was more than 10 miles from Cahokia, which lies about 20 miles southeast of St. Louis. In fact, no stones have ever been found at the site other than those used to craft primitive tools, weapons, and artifacts. Archaeologists Andy Matagoni and Steve Fulton are on duty at the site and discussed the situation, speculating it could be a drain or even a tomb. Comparing the feel of the drill with countless other operations, drill operator told them the Structures seem to be made of large stones, apparently placed together deliberately deep into the western face of the mound. Now, that gave archaeologists more reason to think this just might be something other than a large rock. Now, there's a large region of stone of undetermined shape located 40 feet below one of the terrace surfaces, but until that point in time, prevailing dogma has long been that the Native Americans who built Cahokia worked only with earth, never with stone, which is not found anywhere near the region in question. The Monk's Mound discovery directly challenged thinking at the time about the culture that built Cahokia and suggests that what's beneath the mounds themselves may be much, much older than the mounds. Now, discovery of this massive unidentified stone could push the dates of construction back much further, associating Cahokia with other similar structures that range from 3 to 3,500 years of age. Now, more recently, the discovery made at Cahokia on February 17, 2010, of what appears to have been a Stone Age copper workshop has baffled investigators even further. About 200 yards east of Monk's Mound, an excavation revealed evidence for the only known copper workshop from the Mississippian era. This workshop is being studied in relation to a peculiarity on an engraved drinking cup made from a conch shell found at the top of the 10-foot-high mound. Now, some folks speculate the shell may come from the Gulf of Mexico, and it contains a symbol of an era-like logo with a circle on the arrowhead. And this symbol first turned up in rock shelters excavated in Wisconsin and east central Missouri and been dated about 1000 AD, more than 200 years before the peak of the Cahokia area civilization. Now, the symbols on the shelter walls are similar to the shell fragments found on the mound at Cahokia, and the scholars now believe Cahokia may have been the center of the ancient Mississippian culture. Copper relics have been found throughout the Mississippi Mound Network, but to claim that they all have to be somehow associated or related to Cahokia is, frankly, too hasty an assumption. So the question is, could these earth-covered mounds conceal the remains of much older forgotten ruins? Well, the answer to that will only be determined when there's a full dig conducted. As it is today, less than 1% of the Cahokia mounds have been excavated. And what's ironic about the copper find is this ancient excavation didn't take place at the site of the stone structure, but rather somewhere else, leading to an even more fascinating discovery. And while Lewis didn't get to see all the Cahokia area, he and the party did wander to the mounds at Grave Creek. And after his vivid description of these mounds in his journal and his documentation of finding brass beads in a burial site, the journal is abruptly cut off. Now this raises the question, why everything in the journals of Lewis is detailed meticulously, the topic of the mounds is that section has a number of omissions. According to Guy Moulton, more difficult to explain is Lewis's lack of journal keeping once the expedition got underway. There are no Lewis journals known to exist to cover the first phase of the expedition from May 14, 1804 until the group left Fort Mandan on April 7, 1805. This is the longest hiatus in Lewis's writings, and to historians, it's the most curious gap. Above the surface, scholars teach the mounds of the works of the Native Americans. But below the surface, another tale is emerging of a growing number of scholars who've come forth with evidence that points to a prehistoric civilization that predates the Native Americans. You know, during their encounter with the Flathead of Chalice Indians, September 5, 1805, while in what's today western Montana, members of the Corps of Discovery noted the natives spoke a strange tongue. According to Sergeant John Ordway, these natives have the strangest language of any we've seen. They appear to us as though they had an impediment in their speech or brogue in their tongue. We think perhaps they might be Welsh Indians. Now, Clark noted in his journal only the flathead tongue was a gurgling kind of language spoken much through the throat. Now, Ordway's certain the Corps had discovered the legendary Welsh Indians descended from Welsh Prince Madoc, who sailed to the American continent centuries before Columbus. According to the story, in 1170 A.D., a Welsh prince named Madoc sailed west, far away from the disasters occurring in his homeland. And bards throughout the next four centuries did the same thing. The earliest printed report of Madoc's story is David Powell's The History of Cambria, which was written in 1854. According to what he wrote, Madoc left the land in contention betwixt his brethren and prepared certain ships with men and munitions and sought adventures by sea sailing west. Came to a land unknown where he saw many strange things. Of the visions and returned of this Madoc, there be many fables, as the common people do use in distances of place and length of time, rather to argument than to diminish, but sure it is that he was. And after he had returned home and declared the pleasant and fruitful countries he had seen, he prepared a number of ships and got with them such men and women as were desiring to live in quietness, and taking leave of his friends, took his journey thitherward again, lived in the country into which he came in the year 1170, left most of his people there, and went back for more of his own nation, acquaintance, and friends to inhabit this fair and large country. Now, Guten Owen, the famous bard and historian of Basingworth Abbey, is one of the most influential proprietors of the Madoc myth. His writings are cited as crucial sources by authors such as Richard Deacon, who wrote the influential Madoc and Discovery of America in 1966. This rare book builds a solid case for Madoc's voyage of discovery, despite controversial claims that Madoc's story was invented after 1492. Giving England claim to prior rights in a new world. Deacon's research indicates that in 1625, the Archbishop of Canterbury wrote a royal history that suggested a Welsh prince had discovered America. What if the young Prince Madoc lived on to build ancient settlements and interact with the Native Americans? The ocean current naturally would have carried Madoc and his fleet into the Gulf of Mexico, and once he was there, he would have been attracted to the perfect harbor offered in Mobile Bay. There's another traveler the ancient bard speaks of who also sailed to American shores. This was an Irish monk by the name of St. Brendan, who is said to have discovered sometime between 512 and 530 A.D. an island so big he failed to find the shore after 40 days of walking in a forested land full of fresh fruits and divided by the river too wide to cross. Now, his tales, which were initially published in Latin, were fanciful bestsellers that read more like great entertainment than actual reality. St. Brendan's exploits were quickly synchronized with folklore, and he joined Madoc as another mythological hero. In 1977, historian, author, and ship captain Tim Severin proved a voyage from Ireland to North American mainland was possible. Against all odds, Severin and his crew built a leather boat exactly like those used in the days of St. Brendan and sailed across the dangerous Atlantic Ocean, and they landed safely in Newfoundland. Now, there have been ancient fortifications found along the Mississippi River, and I found a few of them in my own explorations along the Chattahoochee River. And the architecture of these fortifications, like anything previously discovered in the region. In a 1781 letter, Governor John Sevier of Tennessee recounts a conversation he had with a 90-year-old Cherokee chief. Sevier asked the chief about the people who left the fortifications in his country. The chief told him white people had crossed the Great Water and built them. Georgia Historical Commission probably has a copy of that in their files. There are three major forts that stand out against the typical native settlements found along the Mississippi. And all three of these forts share striking similarities to ancient Welsh fortifications. The fort at Chatsworth, Georgia, is virtually identical in layout and method of construction to Dunedin and Castle in Wales, the supposed birthplace of Prince Madoc. As forts were built and territory expanded upriver, a clash with hostile native tribes was inevitable. And it's presumed this hostility forced them to build a defensive stronghold, complete with a massive wall 800 feet long. And the wall, another anomaly of southeastern archaeology, long predates the Cherokees found living there in the 1700s. Cherokee legends called the wall builders moon-eyed people who were said to have fair skin, blonde hair, and blue eyes. Throughout the century, scholars and historians have argued for and against the Madoc story. November 1953, a memorial tablet was erected at Fort Morgan in Mobile Bay, Alabama, by the Virginia Cavalier Chapter, Daughters of the American Revolution. And according to what's written on it, in memory of Prince Madoc, a Welsh explorer who lived on the shores of Mobile Bay in 1170 and left behind with the Indians the Welsh language. Now, the memorial, which was subject to much controversy, was taken down after a hurricane in 1970. Despite resolutions being passed and the support of the governor to restore the plaque, this part of American history is mostly forgotten, covered up, or transparently ignored, which is what researchers do when they find something that doesn't fit. They just ignore it. More than any other tribe, the Mandan of the Northern Plains showed signs of contact with Welsh explorers such as Madoc. They were a small, peaceful tribe that lived at the convergence of the Knife and the Missouri Rivers near Bismarck, North Dakota. They were known for their friendliness, which was the outward expression of a deep-seated ethical philosophy. They shared the northern plains with tribes such as the Hidatsa, Arikara, Assiniboine, Dakota, and the Chippewa. Lands they collectively inhabited were largely similar and had few natural barriers to prevent the mingling of people. And because of this, the various tribes had many traits in common. They all depended on buffalo for food, clothing, and other necessities. But of these tribes, only the Mandan and the Hidatsa lived in Earth Lodge villages when they were first visited by white people in what's now North Dakota. Mandan were further differentiated from their native counterparts in the way they set up their villages, their spiritual beliefs, and their physical appearance. These differences led many scholars to suggest the Mandan derived from different bloodlines than their Northern Plains counterparts. And despite a widespread absence of facts about the Mandan in history books, there's more than enough documentation elsewhere to suggest the tribe actually originated in Europe. Now, the Mandan lived in Earth Lodge homes rather than teepees. Unlike the settlements of the other tribal nations, theirs were permanent. Women of the Mandan tribe tended their garden, prepared food, maintained the lodges while the men spent their time hunting or seeking spiritual knowledge. Villages strategically located on bluffs overlooking the river. Position provided maximum defense and limited any attacks to one land approach. These villages were the center of the social, spiritual, and economic lives of the Mandan people. And the Mandan Earth Lodges are unlike those built by other tribes. These lodges are large, rectangular, and circular huts 15 feet high and 40 to 60 feet in diameter. Each hut had a vestibule entrance and a square hole on top that served as a smokestack. Each Earth Lodge housed 10 to 30 people and their belongings. Villages contained 50 to 100 Earth Lodges. Frame of an Earth Lodge was made from tree trunks, which were covered with crisscross willow branches. And over the branches were placed dirt inside. Type of construction made the roof strong enough to support people on nights of good weather. And the floors of the Earth Lodges were, of course, made of dirt, and the middle was dug out to make a bench around the outer edge of the lodge. Surrounding the lodges, the villages were stockades of poles as high as 6 feet to prevent enemy attack. And in the middle of a Mandan village was a large circular open space that was called the Central Plaza. And in the middle of the plaza was a sacred cedar post that represented the Ark of the First Man, or the Lone Man, a revered hero from their ancient legend. And at the north end of the plaza was the medicine and ceremonial lodge. The arrangement of the lodges around the central plaza represented the social status of each family. The higher in status the villagers were, the more duties that were required to them, and therefore they were located closer to the ceremonial lodge. Now, one strange feature of the Mandan village that didn't correspond with the behavior of the other native tribes was that the Mandan homes were arranged resembling streets. The Hidatsas, another peaceful tribe, were the only other native people who built earthen huts, a practice they said they learned from the Mandan. The rich floodplain fields that surrounded the village made agriculture the basis of the Mandan existence. and the Mandan women were responsible for sustaining the guards within the village. The agricultural year began in April when the women would clear the fields by burning the old stalks and weeds from the previous year's crops. In May, they planted rows of corn, beans, tobacco, pumpkin, sunflowers, and squash to maximum exposure to sunlight. To tend their gardens, women used tools such as digging sticks and rakes and hoes made from wood or buffalo bones. And to protect their gardens from natural predators like prairie dogs and birds and rodents, the women constructed scarecrows out of buffalo hide. They also performed daily cleansing rituals before entering their gardens by rubbing sage over their bodies. They thought this would protect their crops from worms and disease. Harvesting began in late May, August with squash and ended in October with corn. After harvest, women would dry the corn in scaffolds built above the ground. After the corn was dry, women picked the seeds they'd used for the next year's crops, and the rest was buried with other dried garden items in underground storage pits to preserve them through the winter. And these garrets took days to build and were deep enough to require a ladder to get into. When finished, they were lined with grass and buffalo hide. The dried vegetables and seeds were placed inside, and the garrets were then covered with a layer of buffalo hide, a layer of dirt, and grass on top. In comparison with the traditions of the other native tribes, these techniques impressed the white traders and scouts as uncharacteristically advanced. But the most mysterious of the Mandan characteristics was their physical appearance. Unlike other natives encountered by other explorers, the Mandans were reported to have mixed complexions that varied from white to almost white, blue and green eyes, and reddish or blondish red hair. All these characteristics suggest European genetics were at some point introduced into tribal bloodlines. Some theories name Paul Knutsen, a 13th century Norwegian, as a possible candidate for having introduced a Nordic European genetic strain and Christian cultural nuances to the American Midwest. Now, this theory arose because the Mandan built their settlements using an architectural style unknown anywhere else in North America, but common to medieval Norway. Now, in a letter dated January 22, 1804, to Meriwether Lewis, President Jefferson specifically requested the expedition to make contact with and verify rumors of the existence of a white, blue-eyed tribe of natives that had come to be referred to as the Welsh Indians because of the similarities between the language of the Mandans and the language of the Welsh. Now, the original source of these claims can't be pinpointed with any accuracy, but they had circulated enough the issue became a matter of great importance to government officials. Documented accounts began in 1738 when Pierre Gautier de Vernays, Sieur de la Verendrye, took an expedition from his forts in present-day Manitoba to what is now North Dakota in search of this mysterious tribe. During this expedition near the banks of the Missouri River, he found a stone cairn with a small stone tablet inscribed on both sides with unfamiliar characters. Jesuit scholars in Quebec later described the writing on the stone as Tatarian, a runic script similar to Norse runes. Professor Peter Kalm of the Swedish Royal Academy of Sciences interviewed Captain de Verendrye about this discovery in Quebec. This tablet was reportedly shipped to France and stored with other archaeological artifacts in a church at Rouen and buried under tons of rubble by a direct hit during a bombing raid in World War II. Verendrye located the Mandan village in what's now McLean County, North Dakota, between Minot and Bismarck. Large, well-fortified town with 130 houses laid out in streets. The fort's palisades and ramparts were not unlike European battlements with a dry moat around the perimeter. More remarkable, he noted in his journal, many of the Mandan had light skin, fair hair, and European features. And he described their houses as large and spacious, clean with separate rooms. August 24, 1784, the Pennsylvania Packet and Daily Advertiser reported a new nation of white people had been discovered about 2,000 miles to the west of the Appalachians, acquainted with the principles of the Christian religion and extremely courteous and civilized. Well, this, of course, would have thrown a monkey wrench into the plans for a manifest destiny. A pre-existing Christian society would be protected under the papal rules. 1796, Welsh explorer John Evans set out to search for the Mandan, hoping to find proof that their language contained Welsh words. He spent the winter 1796 and 97 with a tribe of Mandan, but found no evidence of any Welsh influence. July 1797, he wrote a letter to Dr. Samuel Jones and said, having explored and charted the Missouri for 1,800 miles and by my communication with the Indians this side of the Pacific Ocean from 35 to 49 degrees of latitude, I'm able to inform you there's no such people as the Welsh Indians. Well, Evans' conclusion was directly contradicted by Lewis and Clark in 1804 and again in 1832 by George Catlin, a lawyer, frontiersman, and pictorial historian who spent several months living among the Mandan. It was through Catlin's accounts and art it was proved beyond what many could doubt that the Mandan indeed were a race descended from European ancestry. Some speculate Evans may not have actually reached an actual Mandan settlement, claiming that the evidence provided by Catlin is indisputable. When the Corps of Discovery entered the world of the Mandan in October of 1804, the tribal leaders were receptive to the goals of the expedition. Lewis and Clark found the Mandan people to be extremely hospitable, and the Corps of Discovery prepared to winter on the Missouri River, building a log fort made of cottonwood tree trunks. The men in the expedition cut the lumber from the riverbanks, building a triangular fort facing the river just downstream from nearby Mandan and Hidatsu villages, and they called it, appropriately enough, Fort Mandan. For the next 5 months, the fort was a beehive of activity as the expedition made preparations for heading westward to the Pacific Ocean. And while they were there, Lewis and Clark interviewed several trappers who would assist as guides and interpreters. It was here Lewis and Clark hired Toussaint Chaboneau, whose wife Sacagawea spoke the Shoshone language. The explorers knew they'd need to communicate with the Shoshone tribe as they neared the headwaters of the Missouri River. And Sacagawea, who was just 14 years old and pregnant and had long been separated from her tribe, would become essential to the success of the expedition. The Corps of Discovery stayed at Fort Mandan in early April when they set out westward along the Missouri River, but not before documenting over a period of 6 months important details about the Mandan, their way of life, their beliefs, and their astonishing almost white appearance. With their Hidatsu friends and neighbors, the Mandan lay at the center of trade along the upper Missouri River, inhabiting what's now central North Dakota. By the time of Lewis and Clark's arrival, they lived in two villages, Matutunha and Ruptahi. Matutunha was located on the western bank of the Missouri, and Ruptahi was located directly north on the river's eastern bank. In contrast to the relations of the Corps with the aggressive Arikaras of the region, the Corps and the Mandan were friendly throughout the duration of the expedition's stay. Mandan supplied the Americans with food throughout the winter at their newly constructed fort, Fort Mandan, in exchange for a steady stream of trade goods. When food became scarce, members of the Corps accompanied the Mandan on a buffalo hunt. Shiheke, which would actually translate as Big White, and Black Cat, chiefs from Matutunha and Rupahaji, often met with Lewis and Clark, and the Corps participated in many of the Mandan ceremony rituals. Lewis and Clark hoped to establish peace between the Mandan and the nearby Arikaras, and in spite of arranging peace talks between the two tribes, conflict broke out again as winter approached. With the experience living among the Mandan, William Clark wrote in his journal, "I sat myself down with the Big White Man Chief, Mandan Chief Big White, Shiheke, made a number of inquiries in the tradition of his nation. He told me his nation first came out of the ground and saw buffalo and every kind of animal, also grapes and plums, and determined to go up and live on earth." In his investigation regarding the origins of the mysterious Mandan, Clark was told of the former's belief in a future state after death, a belief that's also connected with the theory of their origin. The Mandan legend describes a whole nation lived in one large village underground near a subterranean lake. Grapevine extended its roots down to their habitation and gave them a view of the light. Some of the more adventurous climbed up the vine and delighted with the sight of the earth, which they found covered with buffalo and rich with every kind of fruit. They returned with the grapes they gathered, and the countrymen were so pleased with the grapes' taste, the whole nation resolved to leave their dull residence for the charms of the upper region. Well, men, women, and children all climbed up the grapevine, but When about half the nation reached the surface of the earth, a corpulent woman who was clambering up the vine broke it with her weight, closing off from herself and the rest of the nation the light of the sun. When their Mandan die, they expect to return to the original seats of their forefathers, the good reaching the ancient village by means of the lake with the burden of the sins of the wicked wouldn't enable them to cross. Sounds to me like their religious beliefs have a lot in common with Christianity. Well, before we go into another topic, and I've got plenty of topics to talk about, we've got to the point where we've run out of time for today's show. We'll be back tomorrow, and once again, if you listen to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show, until then, have a truly great evening.